And welcome to Squeezing a Lemon. Because we had smoked salmon, you might have just been doing that. The Squeezing the Lemon theme is very much about the fact that, you know, firstly, times are tough, low yield environment, low returns in equity markets, and also very much in uncharted waters. One of the binding themes as we go through the presentation is that we're now getting a higher income yield out of growth assets or risk assets than we are out of defensive or income assets, and that changes a whole lot of things. Bottom line, though, in a pretty tough environment, we're here to ask the question, largely from an asset side perspective, an investment perspective, how can you make your investment book work harder in this environment? Structure of the presentation. We'll speak for about 20 minutes, as indicated. And what I'll first do is provide an introduction and an overview of the investment landscape as we see it, and with some thoughts on the insurance industry from that investment perspective. Whitlam will then further explore some of the current opportunities, just in a few slides. And one thing I'd say about there's a paper that's on the website that goes with this. We're certainly not proposing to cover the whole thing in 20 minutes. One of the features of that paper and one of the things we responded to from the industry was, we're from Russell Investments, how do you like some investment advice? And we're snowstorm of investment advice. What do you need? Some investment advice that, we can understand, it sort of is, not because we're dumb, but because it's not communicated well, and also in a way that sort of flows through into our business. In the paper, although it's not a big part of what we'll be talking about today, is a look at how we can find some paradigms to cook down all the stuff we sort of see, hear and read about into some of the basic conduits that will get what's going on in the wide world of China growth, American recession and euro crisis. How does that get into your company? And it's basically things like, how does it change the term risk premium? How does it change the credit premium? How does it change the equity risk premium? Some pretty basic conduits that actually get that investment landscape into your business. As I said, that's covered in the paper. Whitlam will touch on that. I'll then come back and we'll both have a crack at this idea of squeezing the lemon, making things work a bit harder. I'll get to do the easy squeezes, so they're the more plug-in products. One of the things we do, we actually work a lot with the superannuation industry at Russell, and obviously we're right across many of the investment products that are sort of being newly developed and where the trends are going. Out of sort of 10 innovative products that we're seeing, I've picked out a couple that I think are particularly suitable for the insurance sector. And then Whitlam will come back with a more radical set of solutions and to actually reshape the return profile in such a way as to enable you to capture an equity return premium. The other thing I should say, just in terms of setting this up, is we very much like risk and equity type investments, and that's all about the valuation, it's all about where we are in the cycle, and we'll give you a little bit more colour on that. The second part of the presentation, though, will be all about managing the risks of that. And I wouldn't want you to think that we've suddenly gone cold on the idea. What we are trying to do is to throw out the risk that you don't want whilst enabling you to capture some of the upside and some of the return drivers that you do want. Okay, so that's what it's about, and that's where we're going. And so to sum up, how can you get more out of your assets as a life insurer? What are the current challenges and opportunities in the environment, and what are the risks, and how can you keep those under control? Here's what I mean by a lemon-type environment. Record low yields. When you think about the whole asset side of your book, the amount of sort of bonds, credit, fixed interest type investments there, insofar as that is either making up for an underwriting loss, driving your profit, or throwing up an investment return, it's pretty skinny. Meanwhile, in the equity market, it's been 4 or 5 years of pretty turgid returns, and the only real consolation you have is that less and less of the book of insurers has been in that equity side of things. We have heightened volatility, which causes all sorts of problems and has been one of the drivers of a move to less growth assets. And of course, we have regulatory scrutiny about which Whitlam in particular will be saying a little more. So let's just throw up a couple of slides looking at the gory detail of the business landscape we have right now. Firstly, on yield assets, you go all the way back to, I think we've gone back to 1970 there, and things have never been worse in terms of the return that's being thrown up. Some of the discussions we have with the industry are quick to elicit a response that, we're duration matched. Like, are you sure you're duration matched? Yes, we're very, very duration matched. My concern with that is that there's an element of staticness about that matching. And whilst the sort of a boost, as rates sort of drop, there's a boost to the value of your bond book on the asset side. There's a similar boost to the net present value of your liabilities on the liability side, and it all matches up. As things roll through, that inflation to the future value of your liabilities tends to be more permanent. The capital gain you've made on your bonds tends to be a one-off. And it seems to me that whilst a lot of particularly our larger clients are very diligent about being all over that matching process, the passage of time does start to increase the challenges of doing it. Move on to the equity market, which is a lot of my background in the industry. And I've thrown up here a four-year rolling chart of the All Ordinaries Index since the late 1800s. Obviously eliciting the question, why have I sort of cherry-picked four instead of perhaps three or five, which might be more usual. What I'm getting at here is, firstly, that on that time frame, you can go back to the Great Depression, you can go back before that. There have been very few, if any, occasions, but perhaps 1973, where the equity market outcome has been worse. And the point about 4 years is, and Whitlam will say a little more about this, there's a psychology there. Like the first time that the market falls down, it's a wobble. The second time, it's a coincidence. Year three, and you realise it's a bear market, but we all know that that's about as bad as it gets. Things are about to get better. In year four, there's a real sense of new age thinking in the minds of many people. Suddenly, we've seen everyone from David Murray, Jeremy Cooper, Ken Henry, all the sort of big names are coming out and saying, like, equities are a really bad thing. And it seems to me that that's the typical type of thinking you get at what is, a stage in the cycle about as bad as it ever gets. As I mentioned earlier, the exposure to growth assets within the insurance sector and life insurers here, similar story, though, in general insurance, very much falling. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. Firstly, it hasn't been a bad thing. If we were in rear vision mode and looking back over the last 10 years, should probably have done it earlier. It's worked in a return sense. It's worked in a volatility management sense. One thing we find is that for the listed insurers, there's a real reluctance on the part of investors, having taken an equity risk by buying a listed insurance company, to then have a doubling up of that equity risk because you've got a big equity exposure in the book that's pretty opaque to them and they don't understand what's going on. So I think that's deterred people from going down the risk route. You've got all the Solvency II and internationally and local regulatory equivalents increasing the capital charge. And if we have a think about the integration of the liability and asset side of the balance sheet, which is a key theme of the paper, one thing we've noticed, and this is not going to apply to all insurers, and it's certainly not going to apply to some of the larger domestically based insurers, but it seems to us that if you look at the management incentives, a lot of that is on the sort of sales side rather than the investment side. We believe that for some of the players, it's been much, the cutting edge of the firm has been sales driven in recent years rather than seeing it as an investment sort of cash box, which is more a sort of 1980s phenomenon. And then the other aspect of that is global fragmentation. There are some players who are local outposts of a global behemoth, and the investment of that, and the investments of the Australian operations can get sucked into some sort of global book rather than being tailored to local circumstances. Okay, so in terms of that asset liability interface, it's not clear that there's still a seamless alignment. And as I suggested, in terms of the really radical shifts between growth and defensive assets, there have been some pretty fundamental changes in asset characteristics post-GFC. The do's and don'ts that come first to mind for us is that liability-aware asset management is a good thing. Recalibrating and just doing a whole entire radical rethink about the structure of those investments post-GFC. And indeed, it's not just back foot, it's looking for opportunities as well. Makes sense. But we're not here to talk about wholesale outsourcing or siloing. There's plenty you can do within the organisation. I'm going to hand over to Whitlam to speak about some of these current opportunities in a little more depth, and then we'll come back with some investment ideas that you can perhaps implement.
Thanks, Graham. I thought I'd start off by looking at the cycle of emotions. We all know that many security markets out there operate in cycles. What we've observed is that there tends to be a pattern in the cycle of market returns and the cycle of investor sentiment. Now, what's concerning is that when you usually follow market sentiment, it usually leads you down the wrong path and make the wrong decisions. So, for example, when the market tends to hit the peak of a cycle, investors are feeling good, returns have been good, and so they're more willing to maintain their exposure to risk assets, when really that's the time where you should be decreasing it. And at the bottom of a cycle, returns have been bad, people are feeling bad, and that's when investors are unlikely to take on risk when they really should be. Now, if you listen to the news, you can hear all the dire economic commentary that's been coming out lately. So it doesn't sound too dissimilar to the world that we're in today. Now, we saw briefly in 2009 a spark of optimism, but that was then followed by disappointment given the debt issues in the US and Europe. So sentiment now is pretty low, people aren't happy, and investors continue to be defensive. But what we think is that we might be past the bottom of the cycle now, and that looking at market valuation sort of confirms this view. Taking equities as an example, these two charts show that equity market valuations are currently below what would be considered sort of normal long-term values. On the left, what we've got is a chart of a composite of various different market valuation metrics that we've then normalized. So basically, values above zero mean that equities are expensive, and values below zero mean that equities are cheap. So based on that, we currently think that the Australian and global market is about a half to one standard deviations cheap. And those are pretty attractive opportunities. But there's obviously still the obvious downside risk attached to equities, and that markets could still continue to slide further. But we think the opportunities are there. So the question that we asked is that, are current asset portfolios lemons? That is to say, are they currently positioned to deliver good risk-adjusted returns? Are they making efficient use of capital? And are we at a point now where we need to put on or take off risk? I think in our view, now is not the time to be shying away from risk, as long as you do it in a sensible fashion, and that there are opportunities now where we can work the asset portfolios harder. And that's what we refer to as squeezing the lemon. I'll let Graham take you through the first few examples of how we plan on doing that.
Thanks, Whitlam. Shying away from and or embracing risk is something we can always think about. The other aspect to what Whitlam's just said, though, is this is not a time to be shying away from value. The equity valuations he showed there were cheap and not outstanding. The real killer for me is what great value equities are relative to bonds, which would otherwise be what's sitting in your portfolio. So it's a bit of a two-edged thing, and it's both pointing in the same direction of looking for perhaps a greater exposure to growth assets. I'll be doing the easy examples, and I just wanted to throw up a couple of products that we see increased interest in, particularly on the sort of pension and superannuation side, that seemed to me to really fit in with the low risk nature or the risk averse nature of insurance. So these are substitutes for current risk assets, which nonetheless enable you to step into that space, aiming for smoother investment return streams. First slide's a bit busy, but basically think everything you've ever heard about risk-return trade-off. On the left, we have the traditional idea that cap-weighted equity portfolios are efficient, and if you have some linear combination of those with the risk-free rate, you're going to be doing better than the minimum volatility portfolio shown on the bottom yellow dot. The anomaly that's being observed, and so this is all about, this isn't how it's supposed to be, but this is what we're finding, so you need to take reality into account. It may well be that a minimum variance portfolio, and in equity space you can think of that as sort of lower volatility equities as opposed to high volatility equities, can dominate a cap-weighted portfolio in both risk and return space. This difference between those two lines there, probably not overwhelming. It's also a bit of a challenge that everything you ever learned about risk-return trade-offs has been turned on its head. But if you look at the next chart, we've got some evidence across the world from fund manager Acadian. You can see that across a range of regions over an extended period of time, the bit below the line, we're comparing the blue bars above the line with the black bars. Blue line is minimum variance portfolios, and the black is the benchmark. So by and large, they're either similar or poking their nose in front. And then cover this up, and we're bringing down within volatility space. So the big black bars are the large volatility of the benchmark, but this is a significantly lower volatility of the minimum vol approach. So certainly we're seeing all sorts of interest in moving away from cap-weighted, market-weighted portfolios, and this is just one example of that. Second idea that's... Actually, just before I leave that, there's actually, a big precedent in the 1980s in the general insurance sector for insurers to invest in low-volatility shares, not with any particular idea of getting a great return, but just because they felt that was appropriate. Back in those days, and this is when I started in the industry, the index was probably 40% resources in Australia and 60% industrials. And organisations like IAG and Mercantile Mutual, as it then was, were saying, OK, we'll go 80-20, not because we don't like resources. Everyone knows resources are fantastic, but they're lower volatility. As things turned out, I think it probably added 3% a year to returns just from the fact that the high volatility resources were about to fall apart, and it was a low volatility, low risk asset that actually did better as per that previous slide. Second thing that catches my eye is managed futures. And what I'm interested in here is the volatility exposure within an investment book. The pretty busy slide here. So here I'm talking about like sort of CTA, futures trading strategies. They're often momentum strategies, and they do well in a trending market. If you look at the big quarterly falls over the last several decades in the S&P 500 index, and look at how the Barclays Index of managed futures went, significant downside protection. And where this is coming from is, as soon as you start putting any risk assets into your portfolio at all, you're short volatility. If you've got any sort of equity exposure and suddenly you go into some financial crisis, volatility goes up, your equities go down. It would be great if you could go out and buy option protection for that, but we all know that the implied volatility in the options market is stubbornly higher than the ex-post realised volatility, which means that it's an expensive way to get long volatility. For me, the attraction of managed futures is that they provide an opportunity to get long volatility with a reasonable expectation of getting paid for that as opposed to having to pay for that. I'm getting on thin ground here, though, in terms of the asset liability side of things. It's also true to say, and this is probably more a general insurance comment than a life insurance comment, it's probably also true to say that you're naturally long volatility in your business anyway as an insurer. Although, as I say, I'm on thin ice if I'm trying to draw a link between the volatility in financial markets and the volatility in whatever it is you're insuring. Okay, what about downside risk? What about capital cost? This is where things start getting a little bit more radical in terms of reshaping the return profile of your risk assets. And in particular, we start getting more capital consumptive. You know, a lot of responses, okay, it's fantastic. I get your point that this is a good time in the cycle and a good time in terms of relative valuations to get into equities and growth assets. But, you know, it's capital cost is going to be prohibitive. Whitlam has some ideas for you on that.
Thanks, Graham. Well, what we'll go through quickly here are what we refer to as some of the harder squeezes. So they're harder because they're much harder to implement, unlike the examples that Graham just gave. But what you do get out of it are more sophisticated, more liability-aware strategies. And they could also potentially offer better capital efficiency and better risk management, particularly management within the tail risk. So I'll start off by talking about derivative protection strategies. So what this involves is basically rolling a 12-month index put option every year at a 95% strike at the end of each calendar year. And what it achieves over our back-tested period, which starts from 1979 to now, is pretty much the same return as a standard equity portfolio, but with lower volatility. And in particular, as highlighted in the top right, during the GFC, it suffered a much smaller drawdown thanks to that put protection. But like many things, there are shortcomings. So highlighted at the bottom, during the 87 crash, it provided no protection whatsoever. And also during, say, the early 2000s, where it was a long and steady growth, it underperformed a standard portfolio. Now, the reason why it underperformed during 87 is that while we did have that severe crash in October, over the entire calendar year, the market was actually broadly flat. So the put actually expired worthless in that particular period. So what this highlights is actually the importance of, one, when you choose to roll your derivatives, and two, how frequently you roll them. Another way of looking at that is by examining the realized volatility of these strategies. So we can see here with the put strategy, its realized volatility was systematically lower than a standard portfolio, with the exception of 87. And again, particularly with the GFC period, you can see a very stark difference in terms of volatility. In actual fact, our put strategy went in the opposite direction. Another potential benefit is its impact on regulatory capital. So given the new equity stress test requirements, the capital charge on equities is going to change from a fixed 16% to approximately 36%, depending on where dividend yields are at the time. But if we actually implement a one-year put option over your equity portfolio, then that capital charge comes down to approximately 11%. And then if you use collar strategies as well, that comes down to a further 6%. So we think that it actually is a very attractive option if you currently think that the capital cost for equities is prohibitive, and that these strategies may allow you to maintain your equity exposures while managing the capital cost that's associated with them. But of course, these strategies aren't really trivial to implement. You've got to think about parameter selection, so things like what strikes do you buy your options at, how frequently do you roll them, things like that. You have to think about the liquidity of your derivatives, and that might depend on how big your equity portfolio might be. You've got to think about the counterparty risk that comes with your derivatives. I mean, you've got the option to actually actively manage your derivatives, but that's going to add a whole new layer of complexity. And there are also obvious tax implications with derivatives. So basically, a careful, measured approach has to be taken if you want to consider these kind of strategies. Another category of strategies that we also looked at are what's known as dynamic rebalancing strategies. So these are rules-based strategies, like CPPI, that vary the level of risk assets depending on different signals, whether they're market signals or portfolio signals. And using various different triggers, it will adjust your risk exposures accordingly. So some triggers might be based upon sort of current market volatility. It might be based on, you know, your capital buffer. You can, you know, customize it to whatever you want, basically. But unlike the derivative strategies we mentioned earlier, it doesn't provide any sort of capital relief, but it does provide good risk control. So one example of this are what's called volatility responsive asset allocation strategies. So what these do is basically make sure that portfolio volatility stays below a certain threshold. So in this case, in this back-tested case, we set the ceiling on volatility at basically 8%. So what happens is that when portfolio volatility exceeds this level, then the portfolio will de-risk until volatility comes back to that threshold. Then basically, as you know, volatility subsides afterwards, the portfolio will reallocate back into risk assets. Now, as shown in this chart, our back tests show that these strategies can, again, provide pretty similar returns to a standard equity portfolio over the long term, but at much lower volatility. Another variation of this is what's known as safety-first strategies. What this strategy does is it first picks a level of protection. So say 90% of your current portfolio value, 95%, again, up to you. And then what it does, the trigger that it uses is the probability of falling, or well, basically of staying above that level of protection. So, you know, we want to make sure that the portfolio stays above that protection level with, a 95% probability. When it assesses that the probability of doing that falls below our threshold, so if we did, we use 95%, then again, the portfolio will de-risk to the point where the probability comes back to 95%. In this backtest, what we've assumed is a protection level of 95%, and again, a probability of 95%, and that protection level is also reset every 12 months. And again, it shows that you can get pretty good returns. In this case, it actually outperformed the standard equity portfolio, but at lower risk. And that's just because it's been able to react and de-risk at the right times. We put these strategies to the test during the most recent period of market stress, and it was clear that they provided significantly better downside risk protection compared to a standard portfolio. The safety first strategy in particular performed very well. We also ran a rather simple Monte Carlo simulation over a 24-year horizon to see how these strategies might impact, you know, the balance sheet of a typical life insurer. So we've modelled in real terms because of the long time frame, and we have adjusted for claims, premiums, expenses and investment returns, which we calibrated to the latest APRA statistics. Now, what we found is that a simple comparison between a 100% cash strategy that we have on the left and an 80% cash, 20% put-protected equity strategy that we've got on the right had materially better outcomes. Now, what we've got, the top blue line is your mean level of real assets over time, and then below those lines you've got the 5th percentile, the 0.5 percentile, and the 0.25 percentile. And what we found was that even in the more severe simulations, such as the 0.25 percentile, our modelling did not sort of cross the threshold of insolvency, which is the bright red line at the bottom. So what it shows, at least based on this simple modelling, is that, you know, it allows life insurers, or any insurers in general, the ability to gain exposure to equities and other types of risk assets without necessarily endangering the solvency of the insurer itself. So, I mean, after all that, Graham, what does it all mean? And what are some of the things that we can be doing right now?
Thanks, Whitlam. Yeah, I mean, the key theme there should be very much the relative attractiveness of equities to fixed interest. The idea that a modest risk asset exposure can have a significant impact for the better without too much impact on the sort of the risk cost. And there are dynamic and derivative overlay strategies that can stop that all getting out of control. Before we go to questions, the final thought I'd leave you with is, I think it would be a tragedy if the strategies we go into the next 5 years with are those strategies which would have done really well over the last 5 years. And in terms of sort of regulatory interaction with the industry, my view, regulators are notorious for sort of like fighting the last war. Nothing we've said here is antagonistic to the substance of what the regulators are trying to achieve. So, you know, it's definitely the put protection that Whitlam described, you know, really does provide that protection which is appropriate, which I think the regulator's looking for. What we would be concerned about is if the the rush to avoid a GFC all over again took us out of good value equities and put us into gratuitously overpriced fixed interest, all in the name of risk management. That's it from me. A few moments for questions.
All right. Thanks, Graham. Well, we're still about 20 minutes away from the RBA announcing whether we're in even a lower interest rate environment. But in the meantime, has anybody got any questions or comments? Could you please say who you are when you get up to the mic?
Hi, thank you. So, Ismar Tuzovic, JP Morgan. That was a good presentation. I mean, I just want to make, I guess, a couple of comments. I mean, obviously, relative sort of valuation is very important here, and you know, you emphasise the kind of the relative attractiveness of equities to fixed interest. I mean, but have you? I mean, how do you conclude that? So, how do you reach sort of that conclusion? I mean, is it just basically the sort of the lower yield environment versus the current PE levels? Because you also said that, you know, compared to sort of historic PE valuations, that equities are undervalued. But that doesn't sort of take into account the sort of the state of the equity market now, and that maybe a lot of the sort of industries are going through structural change, and you know, so you're looking at online retail, which is coming and destroying sectors of our, you know, economy. So to kind of say, yeah, like market, you know, traded at 15 times historically, and now it's at, you know, 10, and therefore we are at this discount, doesn't take that into account. So I think from that point of view, that doesn't justify sort of the equity cheapness, but I think your other point, which is the bonds versus equities, is probably more warranted. But I want to hear a bit more about that and what your thoughts are.
Your point's a good one, and it's whenever you get an anomalous piece of data, eight times out of 10, it tells you that there's something wrong with your data cleaning and you should have fixed it up and you shouldn't take that too literally. And one or two times out of 10, it's telling you something really important and you should take it on board. In terms of your response to, you know, some of the sort of dire stories we see about retailing various sectors of the market, maybe for one time in, one or two times in 10, you know, things have totally changed. And we should take it seriously. And the worst thing you can do is to go on some of these historical relationships. I guess we're making a probabilistic statement that, and that was the point about the four-year rolling thing. At the darkest hour, to some extent, you have to close your eyes and believe that we have got sucked into just by being beaten up for 4 years in a row. Whilst there's some truth in it, we're over discounting the problems rather than under discounting them. And I could be wrong, and you could be right. Maybe things have radically changed. That's sort of partly where I'm coming from. Second point I'd make is the inflation environment. There is a very long-standing, and I'm talking like sort of 50 years in Australia, relationship between PEs and inflation. That's called the rule of 20. And there'll be a lot of mathematicians in the audience, so cover your ears or your eyes or something when I start adding reciprocals and multiples. But if you add the PE multiple to the inflation rate, not only does that average out at 20, but it sort of cycles around that with relative frequency. So it's not as though you've spent the first 25 years above and the next 25 years below. With an inflation rate not far off 2 and with PEs up around 12, you've probably got 6 PE points of upside relative to that historical relationship. So even if there's sort of, I'll give you three PE points for the fact that things really have changed and I still want to keep half of it, that still gives me a lot of upside. The other thing that concerns me, and going back to sort of my thoughts about, you know, sort of how APRA thinks about things, been looking at the proposed prudential requirements that are going to be rolled out we've got prudential requirements for insurers, we've got them for banks, why don't we have them for superannuation? You look at the focus of that, and it's all about liquidity, which is the last problem we had. It's nothing about inflation, which may well be the next problem we have. And again, I'm interested in assuming that whatever the future holds, it's not going to be the same type of abnormal as we've just had. So there'll be some thoughts on that.
Thanks for the presentation. Thomas Cherin, Merrill Lynch. Wondering, in your modelling, how do you take into account the liquidity element and the counterparty risk? Because obviously the assumption is all this protection is going to be available when it's needed, and clearly in the last few years that's been the biggest assumption that's not held in some cases. So perhaps that aspect of risk is missing from the analysis, and whether you see that as a big deficiency when people go and implement these strategies?
Well, you're definitely right. I mean, I suppose in terms of the modelling that we've done so far, we've tried to keep it simple just so we could basically elicit, you know, the key insights. I think if we were to actually do it in a sort of real-world environment, it's going to vary from insurer to insurer because obviously their portfolio is going to be quite different, both in terms of composition and size. And you're also right. You know, we've got to sort of take into account liquidity. How you would actually model that?
My biggest response to that is the same story about fighting the last war. That we've had a liquidity event and a counterparty risk event. That's probably a once in 30-year event, even if we're unlucky. Lasted 2 to 3 years. It's absolutely cleaned out everything that was going to be a problem. I would expect all sorts of blow-ups at a regular 5-year basis over the next 30 years, of which, I'd put my hand up for inflation for being one likely one, and there is a, it's a long way down the track that that's going to happen, and it's easy to think about that. In terms of the liquidity, and this is in terms of the liquidity of the options market, I've sort of sat down to discuss with a number of insurance companies, some of them quite large. There's a range of views on that, but up to, you're sort of talking up to, you're in the billion mark rather than the sort of hundreds of millions mark before we believe liquidity becomes something you're really going to start changing what you can do. I guess, unfortunately, there's a mismatch with the regulation. In a sense, the regulator likes something that's clean and contractual, without asking too many questions about the contract, because you can do the math and it's going to drop out, and when you hit the put protection, you get the put protection, subject to your definition of the word get and whether that actually comes through. Some of the more dynamic strategies, the Safety First, the CPPI, are quite light because they're sort of algorithmically based, unless you get something that was really out of the way, like the 1987 gap where you just lost liquidity for 25% of the market in a day. Bar something like that, you can actually manage it a lot better, but you're not going to get the same capital cost relief from doing that. So, no, it's definitely substance what you're saying. It's just a matter of managing that, and that's why it's something we work hard at.
All right, I think we better wrap it up there. Perhaps you'll just join me in thanking Graham and Whitlam for their presentation.